Hello, everyone, and welcome back to The Political Impact. I'm your host, Kelsey Hickman, and today I'm joined by a very special guest, Blair Cullen. Hi, Blair. How are you today?
I'm great, Kelsey. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate this opportunity.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining The Political Impact today. And hopefully it will be an insightful conversation on your academic career and on Canadian regionalism. We can start with introducing yourself. Who is Blair Cullen?
Okay, I guess to put that in the most simple terms. So my name is Blair. Currently in relation to politics, I'm the instructor for PO264, which is the practice of politics in Canada. I'm also a bit of a traitor in the Canadian political science world because I'm also a geographer as well. I'm a PhD candidate in the University of Waterloo, Wilfrid Laurier University graduate geography program. So I've been fortunate enough to have the opportunity to teach this course while I'm doing that, which I've been thrilled to do because Canadian politics is a big passion of mine.
Yeah, it's awesome. And could you detail a little bit on your educational background?
Sure. So I, in high school, I wasn't much of a serious student until I learned that I could leave home if I went to school in a certain program somewhere else. So I wanted to be originally a history teacher, because if you love history, there's not a lot of other things you can do and still have a decent living. So I applied to a bunch of current education programs in Ontario, which back when I did it, there was only five. And what concurrent education is just a fast track teaching. So instead of doing your undergrad and then applying to teacher's college, you gain acceptance in the first year and you do practicums all through your undergrad and education courses as well. And then you're guaranteed a spot in teacher's college. So I did the Trent University, Queen's University concurrent education program, which is no longer actually a program itself. When I was done that, I went to teacher's college. Teacher's college did not excite me in any way. I went to Trent University for my undergrad, which is a very liberal arts school and very social justice oriented. And I'd spent 4 years trying to critique the system and what's wrong with the system, then to go to teacher's college and say, hey, now you're part of the system, you belong to it, and you have to share and promote what it's about. It was not something that my young idealist self really liked. I did it because I was in the program anyway and I'd done all the work, but it wasn't something that didn't really stimulate me in any way. So I was applying for master's of programs in my first month of teacher's college because I just knew it wasn't for me. And a lot of the educators I met were much more mature and serious minded, and that's just not where I was at that aspect of my life. So I was very fortunate. I had a wonderful supervisor who I did my honors thesis with at Trent University, geography, by the name of Mark Skinner, who's a fantastic scholar and person. So I went to do my master's with him and back to Trent in Canadian Studies and Indigenous Studies program, which was an interdisciplinary approach to anything associated with those two topics. And that, to me, program was very seminal because it really taught me not just like my own perspective of Canada as a white male, but also like the other side of it and the side that I've been exposed to during my youth. But not only just like the other side, but how the two are supposed to interact and talk and hopefully try and, you know, progress. So that was a very academically challenging, stimulating growth period for me. And then after that, I decided to do my PhD because there's just something about research, like when you're able to study something you want and you're interested in and it counts for something, it's just like one of the best deals in the world. Like it's just,
absolutely.
For me, it was so exhilarating. And it's like I was very fortunate in my MA because I got a number of scholarship grants, So I was really able, I wasn't limited in the type of project I could do because I had money to do something bigger. And I just couldn't get enough of it. Like I remember showing my colleagues during my MA, I had over 500 pages of transcripts from interviews for my, wow, for my master's thesis. And it was just, I just couldn't get enough of it. I lived in those transcripts for months. So after doing the MA, and because I did like a pretty intensive thesis one as well, I decided that I wanted to take the next step, because within any type of research job or academic job, if you want to get any type of grants or anything like that to do research, they're always looking for that PhD beside your name. So
yeah,
that's okay, pretty much education in a nutshell.
Yeah. And it definitely makes sense that you're remaining in this academic field and staying around these peers and colleagues that are interested in what you're interested in, like the like-mindedness, and it's very inspiring. So that's awesome. What essentially got you interested in politics? Would you say that you've always been interested in politics, or do you have a moment that you can recall that really sparked your interest?
Actually there's one moment, although it wasn't like I had the moment and then I got like just super interested in politics right away, but I can still remember, so I'm a millennial, and I can still remember I was in grade 9 geography class during 9/11 when the Twin Towers were struck down. I still remember to this day one of my classmates walking from outside the class to find out what was going on and coming back and telling us. And I had I was just shocked. Like I'd never heard of anything like this. I wasn't like mature, educated enough at the point to understand it. And it was so like kind of outside of my realm of thinking at the time. And I was just, that really kind of made me want to understand the world more and what that was all about. And then that, and I always loved history, and history, like it was just a natural kind of segue to wanting to, so much about history. Oh, I shouldn't say that. The discipline of history has changed. It used to be much more politically based a while ago. Now it's more social oriented and kind of focused on the everyday, but there was a time when that was, politics was like the central piece of it. And so just my love of history kind of led me towards politics. But politics for me, and I think I should say this because it's, I don't know, at first it wasn't like I loved politics, but like when I was applying to teachers college, and this is unfortunate and thankfully it's changed, political science wasn't something you could take in like as a teachable. So you want to be a high school teacher, you have to pick like two disciplines which you're going to specialize in, and political science wasn't available, like it wasn't a thing. So like if you wanted to teach politics in high school, the closest thing you either had to do civics, which is like a bird course which no one takes anywhere seriously enough. Kelsey should know that, I'm sure, because if you're interested in civic education, it's literally half a semester. The educators who do it, it's not what they're interested in. It's just something they got pawned off at least in my experience. And so the only way, if you wanted to study politics in high school or cover it, was to do history. Cause that's there may be some pieces of politics in like the social sciences, like psychology and sociology and that type of thing. But it's like, if you really wanted to focus and learn about it, history at that time was the only avenue to do that. So because of that, politics, like until I got to university, it was more of a hobby because I couldn't find a way to incorporate it into my like professional life in any way. Like even, because when I did my undergrad, I was a history geography major. I didn't take political science because it didn't give me that path to teaching. Now, like I said, thankfully that's changed now. But like, I think one of the things that I think is the purpose of this podcast is to get young people engaged in this type of stuff. And that's to me, when you gave me the questions, I started reflecting about this, is that there aren't those avenues within high school that you would hope there would be. And don't get me wrong, there's clubs and activities and, you know, that type of thing that you can do, but it's all extracurricular. It's
right.
Not like a core part of the curriculum. Like, for instance, in Ontario, like, you have to take civics and careers to graduate from high school, but there's no type of political science course besides that, which is, again, arguably political science, maybe yes, maybe no, but you can't do that. So anyways, that's a long answer to a short question.
No, but so valid in that calling it a almost neglected discipline, right? We don't see it as we see it as part of being a citizen. It's just the default. But I think there's been a disconnect because there's so much to learn civic education wise and learn about politics. And I think how you said, you know, going into history was the only route, politics is like an umbrella that it affects everything, right? It's interconnected to history. My choice of studying political science was my intrigue to world issues. And there's also geography, which is what you're doing your candidates here now.
Did you take world issues in high school then? Like, was that a
yes.
course that you took? Yeah.
Yes. World issues, but.
No, you can't. And like then it was a geography course. Like that's right. The umbrella it was in. I just remember that course so well because that was, there's not a lot of teachers who have masters or PhDs. And that was one of the only courses where the teacher actually had a PhD. So like was so engaged and just this huge brain with all of this information in it. And it was like getting it basically in hindsight, it was like getting a taste of university. Before you got there. I didn't know that at the time, but afterwards, that's exactly what it was.
Yeah. And it was so, and that's what my moment was. That's what sparked my interest was learning about different world issues from different theoretical perspectives and seeing how I can, utilize my agency and make a difference. But we're saying that politics intersects with different disciplines. Towards what you're focusing on, how would you say politics intersects with geography in terms of Canada? Which is a big question, but dumb it down.
It is a big question. There's obvious ones to start with. Like, so for instance, geopolitics is I have a couple of colleagues who are in my program who are like, that's what they study, even though it's a geography program. That's in terms of migration in the Caribbean or the political economy of Eastern Europe, like that's kind of the geopolitics stuff is what they study. So that's the first obvious thing, but this is a big question. So you can address it to a number of ways. I think there's, in my experience academically, there's pretty much a good amount of overlap between human geography, which I am. Everyone, when they think about geography, when I tell them, they think I'm studying rocks, stones, and streams, and that's not the case. I'm a human geographer, and there's a very clear distinction, and sometimes it's a division between those two parts of the discipline. And not a lot of people who know geographers who study geography outside of high school quite get that, but because it's human geography, like just in my own research on immigration in Canada, I use political scientist works a lot. There's a lot of people who study, there's a lot of articles that are in political science journals that could be in geography journals and vice versa. So there's a lot of overlap there, I guess, academically. And in terms of, I don't know, It's different because political science is, between those two, it's the more established of the disciplines. It's been part of universities forever. Human geography, in comparison, is a more recent development, and it's part of an evolution of the discipline, where political science, you know, it's been entrenched as part of universities for centuries. Like, it's not new. So there's a much more kind of specific and rigid idea of what that is. So I guess that's the best I can do for between between the two, but you know, there's people who are much smarter than I am who would have a much more elaborate answer for you on that one.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good way to start thinking about them in the same conversation for sure. And I should disclose that I'm actually in your class for Practice of Politics in Canada. And we had a really fascinating conversation that made me want to interview you about Canadian regionalism and what the geography of certain groups of Canadians and how that impacts our politics. So if you could explain in your own way how we would classify the regions of Canada.
When you say, you mean like literally like what areas?
Yeah, if someone had never heard about it before, never experienced regionalism and an academic format or been exposed to it, how would we describe it? What are the regions of Canada? Okay. What am I talking about?
Okay, so the first one, I think, which to make it this is as easy as possible here, is I would say you have, you know, Western Canada, which is British Columbia, Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba. British Columbia, it can kind of go in and out depending on what you are talking about, because I think it's distinct from the prairies in a number of ways. But at the same time, if you look at its economy and the way it's developed, there are similarities. And in some cases too, historically, even there's overlap between the politics. The prairies, you know, Saskatchewan, Alberta, Manitoba, they're very distinct as well. So they could be their own entity or their own, or part of the Western Canada designation as well. Those three provinces are, I don't know, they're fascinating to me because, you know, how they define, like, for instance, so sometime in the past 5 or 6 years, they tried to set up like a free trade zone within that because there's so little trade and economic activity between provinces in Canada since the advent of free trade, and even a bit before, it's, you know, always been north-south trade patterns as opposed to east-west. But when they did that, they didn't include British Columbia, which I always found strange. Then there's Central Canada, which are Ontario and Quebec. And obviously it's not always, Quebec shouldn't always be slotted within that, just purely from a technical term, I think, Ontario and Quebec, and because of the history, but like Quebec is its own distinct entity. There's really no question about that. But I think why you can kind of put them somewhat together is because Ontario has always had a historical relationship with Quebec. And they're always kind of have their ears to the ground or their eyes open as to what's going on there. And then again, you get to the Maritimes, which is PEI, Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, Newfoundland, and Labrador. Again, I think Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, and PEI are much similar. Newfoundland and Labrador, again, is very distinct. And this is one of the things that we don't talk about a lot, and we should when it comes to Canadian regionalism, is Newfoundland and Labrador. If you look at, you go across the country in terms of the people who consider themselves most distinct and separate from Canada, in a lot of cases, that's the Newfoundland and Labrador. And that's because they've had such an interesting, unique history where they only joined Confederation in 1949. The relationship between church and state was different. They were a colony for longer. So they weren't under the purview of Canada for a long time. So they very much, and if you look at polls in that, in terms of like, you know, people in provinces who identify the most with their province as opposed to their country, you know, a lot of people don't get, Newfoundlanders beat Quebecers in that regard, which, you know, you would never think would be the case if you look at conventional wisdom around these things, but it is. And for Newfoundlanders, you know, they don't, it's different because they don't see a need to, you know, they have different objectives and motivations than Quebec in terms of, you know, doing what they need to do to protect that identity. But it means just as much, even though they go about that differently. So I think that's, you know, the territories are the territories. No one really talks about them nearly as much as they should. And I don't think there's really that great of understanding. Well, you pull up any Canadian politics textbook and unfortunately, they're an endnote or a footnote rather than anything. So, you know, that's an oversight, but
Right. And you could maybe emphasize that in the human geography discipline about how what kind of groups of people that live in the territories, majority of those are indigenous groups in their own reserved land. So that definitely differs from the major, or I shouldn't say the majority, but Eurocentric Canadian legislation and their values, and the separation is actually province and territory, which is bizarre, but you know.
No, it's been that way for like since Canada became its own country in 1867, right? So it's not news.
Different values and different wants of each of these regions that we're talking about. That's kind of why they're so distinct, and not province by province, but more of a region aspect. Could you maybe touch on an example or two of a regional conflict in Canada that maybe would spark someone's understanding of what regional disputes look like in our political system?
Okay, yeah, I'll get to one of those, but I think I have something a little more interesting that's along those lines first. So many Canadians are familiar with the War of 1812, which, just to put it in a very simple, short synopsis, is when America decided they were going to try and take back what at the time were still Great Britain's colonies, which was, you know, Canada in terms of its territory, which we know today. Now, the Americans were unsuccessful in that pursuit, but I think if you look at like a map of where all the battles happened and where the fighting was, it was mainly in Ontario and some parts of what we consider Quebec today. If you go further east down to like New Brunswick and states like Maine, they were friendly during this time. There was this war going on literally like hundreds of kilometers west, and Maine and New Brunswick were as friendly as could be. There's another example of this after when Confederation actually came to fruition in the 1860s, Nova Scotia had thought they got a raw deal from the Confederation. So there was major discussions of them joining the United States because they were so irritated and annoyed with how things had panned out. And they were going to use joining in the States as kind of like this threat to try and get a better deal because they weren't happy with how Confederation panned out. So it's, and this goes to like, okay, I will come back to your question, but I'm going to go a bit further here. This is, you know, we talk about an issue which illustrates, you know, regional cleavages in Canada, and it's the relationship with the U.S. in Ontario and Quebec. For much of Canada's history, there's this fear of the Americans that they were going to annex us, that they were going to just, their culture was going to overwhelm us. We are never going to be able to have our own identity. You know, we were just basically going to come, you know, Americans 2.0. And that is a very kind of central Canadian mindset. If you go further west to the prairies, they have a very different outlook. You know, they have a very much similar frontier mentality that much of the United States does. And they don't see the Americans and the US as the same type of threat or the same type of thing. You can look at this one example where I've studied this is Petro-Canada. So when Petro-Canada was introduced, originally it was a state government of Canada organization that was meant to increase Canadian ownership, mainly in the Alberta oil patch. And if you look at House of Commons debates from when that was drafted, and you look at the differences in terms of what members of parliament from the West say to the East, you wouldn't even know you're in the same country. Like the concerns and the issues are so different, and it's still like, it's a mammoth thing. It has a major impact on each both central Canada and the prairies. But they have such a different mentality to it. And if you look at all of these Canadian textbooks over the years in history and political science, it's always about this fear of the United States. And I don't think that's a national fear. I think that's a very regional one, but we don't talk about it as a regional one. So going on that point to your question about a regional conflict that made a big difference, I think, and it took a long time, you know, Alberta, Saskatchewan joined Confederation in 1905, I'm pretty sure. They didn't get full control of their natural resources, which, as we all know, are essential to their prosperity to this day, until 1930. They had to fight for 25 years to get something that was owed, not just like owed to them as a favor, that was legally part of the British North America Act, Canada's Constitution, that Ontario and Quebec and the Maritimes already had access to. They had to fight 25 years just to get that. And that, I think, is like one thing, because that kind of history, or that conflict, you know, it never stopped. Like that, to this day, you can go to Petro-Canada, the National Energy Program, even the Maritimes, when there was in Newfoundland and Labrador, and they found offshore oil, and Stephen Harper feuded with, what's the Newfoundland premier's name? Danny. His name is escaping me right now. I forget his name. Anyways, very notable Newfoundland premier. Oh, what is that's going to bother me? I don't know his last name. Anyways, that was just another dispute of which this, you know, kind of carried on. So I think, you know, this, the whole idea of natural resources and the conflict over them as it relates to the West, that's kind of, you know, that's been a major fundamental piece of, yeah, of regionalism in Canada.
Yeah, and you've seen, you know, historically in the West, the creation of new federal parties in attempts to try and emulate those values in their in our you know, House of Commons. If they've been successful, that I think that's up to personal interpretation. Looking at the main parties now and where our elections seem to lie. But it's definitely a very important part of Canadian politics, is these regional disputes, and I think not necessarily neglected or overlooked, but I do think that there's a sense of our media being Americanized and our understanding of our political system to be Americanized as well. So I don't think we necessarily give as much time to our regional divides as we should.
It's not talked about. Like, so for instance, Kelsey mentioned Washington State. Right now I'm instructing PO 264, and you know, I have politics students in there, engaged politics students who have, you know, background and interest and passion for these things. And earlier in the course I introduced the concept of the Laurentian consensus, which is, to put it very succinctly, you know, the idea that the central Canadian elites in Ottawa, Montreal, and Toronto have controlled, you know, kind of the power levers of Canada since Confederation, even before. Now, that Laurentian consensus, the way it's packaged, is a nice, you know, slogan or concept and grab onto. I was very surprised at the number of students who had never heard that term before, and I was also surprised, like, and I'm not blaming them. I'm not saying like that's their lack of knowledge or anything like that. I'm saying like something like that, it hasn't been popularized or hasn't been entrenched nearly as much as you would think based on, and it's interesting because, as I mentioned too, in that lecture, it's a uniquely Canadian thing, you know, and it's not like in the US where it's, you know, two states in one part of the country who are controlling so much of the politics. It's much more distributed. There's regions that fight back and forth, but the fact that that's not like, you know, more part of it, and maybe it's because, you know, we just want that to exist under the surface as Canadians, like, because it's more of kind of the less savory aspects of politics. It's more conflict, it's more disagreements, that type of thing. But like, if you go across Canada, I always say this, you know, there's pretty much, and this is generalization, but four things that all Canadians agree on: hockey, curling, public health care, and immigration, pretty much, except for the recent Quebec government, which is trying to reduce it a bit. But other than that, those four things they agree on, once you get past that, it's not as easy.
Right. Yeah. And I think that the understanding of our political ideologies and the political parties is very Americanized or dumbed down to be two-party system, which is not always the case, right? There's different parties, there's different provincial parties that go into that regionalism sectors that should also be studied. And you mentioned the Laurentian consensus. I think maybe a more familiar term would be I always heard the phrase growing up, you won't win an election without Quebec, right? Which is which is essentially the Laurentian consensus in practice, was that both Ontario and Quebec were deemed as central Canada, as the dominant Canada, and that's what won federal elections. As we can see now, historically, it's not always 100% foolproof, but it is still very necessary to our understanding of these regional disputes and why they're significant, for sure.
No, absolutely. And that's like what you were saying about Quebec, that phrase, that's exactly, that was part of Canadian political wisdom since the dawn of Canada. Like that's absolutely something that has never, ever, even I mentioned when I did that lecture, you know, a lot of people don't realize Stephen Harper put on a full court press to try and get Quebec to come into the Conservative, not all, but parts of Quebec to become a part of the Conservative Party, because, you know, he understood that if the Conservatives were ever going to get a majority government one day, that was going to have to be the path. Now, he moved away from that and he found another way to do it. But that just shows you just how, you know, here's this person whose roots lie in the Reform Party in Western Canada, who's written numerous things that are, to put it politely, not complimentary to Quebec. And then for him, once he gets into office, to kind of throw all that to the wind and say, you know, this is what we have to do now, I think that just, you know, speaks to that dynamic that you mentioned in a very illustrative way.
Absolutely, yeah. It's very interesting. I definitely know that people distinguish Quebec as its own. It's a French province, and it has its own culture and very deep rooted. It's very close to us as well geographically, right? People are more maybe more prone to go on vacations there, or you know, have family there, etc. So that kind of
they have it's a different lifestyle. Like I'll never forget, I'm not a huge fan of Toronto. I love visiting. I don't love staying there. And every time I go to Toronto, all I think of is congestion and concrete jungle and, you know, people being kind of the worst of what an urban environment can be in a lot of cases. And I still remember the first time in Montreal, which is, you know, it's not as big as Toronto, but it's still, you know, a large metropolis by any standards. And I just couldn't get over how relaxed people were.
Yeah.
And I don't mean like sitting around doing nothing. I just mean like they were just so much more chill and not like in a rush or hurried or anything like that. And I had never been to a big city before that was like that. And I was just like, wow, this is different. Cause you always assume based on the numbers and the size, that's the way it's going to be. But it was just a totally different vibe there.
Absolutely.
Than so many other big cities, not just in Canada, but around the world.
Yeah. A side note is the French are so laissez-faire, like the stereotype reigns so true. And you get that. I got the opportunity to do a study abroad in France. So seeing that in France, but I also have many ties to Montreal, and I've worked there this past summer. So in Montreal, it's very similar to the French lifestyle. The you know, you work so that you can live, you don't live to work. And that kind of mentality coming from, I'm from GTA, I'm from Toronto, the capitalist mindset is set in stone. So it's a different lifestyle, and it's refreshing. And it's you know, you learn from that kind of thing. You learn from being exposed to that. So to be exposed to these different regions in Canada and their values and why and the history behind that is so, so important. And it's so important for students to be involved and to understand that. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's the other thing too. I think just to take the conversation back to regionalism, I think, and again, I, as someone who grew up in Ontario, I was guilty of the same thing. I used to sleep under a Canadian flag. I was very patriotic, and I didn't realize until going to university that patriotism that I had for Canada was very much an Ontario-centric thing.
Right.
It was not just, like at the time I thought it was just, you know, that's how everyone is across Canada. I'm not saying that other provinces aren't patriotic. I'm just saying it's a different brand and it's a different kind of, it's more upfront. Like if you go to, one of the things so different, so I've been fortunate to be in cottage country in different provinces. You go to cottage country in Ontario, I challenge you to find me a cottage that doesn't have a Canadian flag hanging on it or on its property somewhere.
Right.
I really do. You want to have a fun game, or even you can make it into a drinking game on everyone stay sober because it'd be so difficult to find. But like everyone's got a flag up. You go to other provinces in places like that, it's not always the case.
Interesting. Yeah, no, I completely agree. There's something about, or Central Canada, right? And the dominant, because we have the most people, and this is where the capital is, and this is where, you know, the economic hub is, the banking industry. And to come from that and then to learn, you know, you're always told as an Ontarian, oh, they hate you. Oh, they don't like you. They don't like Torontonians.
I don't get that so much as an Ontarian. As a Torontonian, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
As an Ontarian, I don't think it's such a bad, because the other thing too, right, is that like in a lot of cases, just to make this like a little more specific, a lot of cases that criticism is Southern Ontario.
Yes.
It's not Northern, sorry, I'm getting really geeky with my geography here, but yeah. It's not, you know, you don't see many provinces across the country taking shots at Northern Ontario. That's
right.
Not really a Canadian pastime, but that's Southern fair. Ontario, yes. Yes.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
You don't have to listen long to hear that.
Yeah, yeah. So growing up, I did connect that to this kind of deeper rooted regional cleavages that are part of Canadian history. So that's really important to connect that and to, you know, deepen our understanding of why Canadian politics act out the way that it does. Switching gears a little bit, just to kind of round out the interview, talking about the importance of being politically active and being a active citizen in Canada and in your local community. What to you, Professor, does being politically active mean to you?
The first thing I think, and it's just like on a very basic level, is just civic literacy. And what I mean by that is just like being well-versed and engaged in current issues. And that can take a variety of forms. That could just be something like reading your local newspaper or following, you know, certain politicians or public figures on social media or watching the news. I say reading a newspaper, that makes you sound really old because no one reads newspapers anymore. But just that on a basic level, I think it's just, you know, being engaged and informed with these types of things. And that doesn't even mean like you have to be a political junkie. It just means that, you know, you have some sense of what's happening with the world around you. So I think the kind of the fundamental component for me and which I was trying to impart to students is just the civic literacy. Because the other thing too is that from a historian's perspective is that, you know, a lot of people don't know Canadian history the way you would hope they would. If you look up studies and polls on this, frankly, sometimes it can be a bit embarrassing. And it's nice because, you know, it's nice the fact that, you know, our history isn't so pushed in our faces that we have to, you know, confront it every day. But at the same time, you know, it is important to be knowledgeable and informed about these things. Like, I'll just give you a really small example. So I have done research on immigration in local communities, and immigration technically is constitutionally concurrent jurisdiction between the federal government and the province. You talk to municipalities, a lot of municipalities these days will have like customer helplines. You can call in with your issue and they'll address it. And I've talked to municipalities and, you know, 70% of the calls they get are not municipal issues. They're provincial or federal. And I think that speaks to something else in terms of, you know, Canadians understanding their constitution and their government structure and where it kind of falls. You know, it's not exactly not just top of mind, but, you know, the knowledge isn't there the same way. So yeah, civic literacy, I think, is kind of the main thing I would say about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And why do you believe that it's important for students to be a part of the conversation in local and national government?
Well, I think it's important because it affects students so much. Like, I don't know, this is just my own personal view, but like, now is the time students have so much, I shouldn't say so much time, not the right way of saying it. Now is the time where students can get engaged and learn about things in a way they never might be able to. And, you know, I'm not always a fan of the term finding yourself, but in terms of politically finding yourself, just getting engaged with those issues and learning and reading and asking questions, you know, it's something that it's useful, it's productive, it can be very satisfying, but that doesn't have to be, like I mentioned, ways you can get involved. You know, there's so many ways to get involved in politics. Like, it could be something as simple as working for a local, provincial, or federal campaign just as a volunteer to get a feel for it. It could be attending. One of my things I love to do when there's public forums or universities putting on talks or lectures, attending those and getting a feel for those. But also just like joining causes, I think, is another, you know, whatever cause may be near and dear to your heart. Nowadays, there are just so many ways to engage with people and like access them in a way that they never could, or the way that we couldn't, at least when I was growing up. Yeah. So I guess to go back to your original question, it's important because these are your issues. And the other thing too, I think sometimes students get kind of apathy in terms of they think it's not going to make a difference. But like one of the, you know, kind of transformative figures when I was growing up was Obama. And, you know, he demonstrated that if enough students and young people show up and vote, you know, they can make a difference, not only in who gets into government, but also who, you know, governments are going to be receptive or attentive to once they get in power. You know, there's power in voting, and then sometimes I think that can get lost on young people, unfortunately.
Yes, absolutely. And that's like the root of my passion to research, you know, political participation as well, is that the younger generation, the 18 to 32, it's often underestimated. It's often disenchanted because we don't get into the economic sector as heavily in our politics until later in life. So I think that it's important to get involved and to get involved early so that you can, you know, be an active participant and actually engage in these conversations that do involve you and do affect you for sure.
So I'm curious, if you don't mind me asking, what are typically the reasons that you come across for lack of engagement amongst younger people?
Started to question why I had so much more political education than my peers, and why I was getting this and it was helping me in my in me being an active citizen, and it's helping me in you know, in voting and in how I view the world. But it's also my choice to study political science. I don't necessarily believe that it's something that should be a privilege. It's something that should be a right. Mm-hmm. And you should have a right to civil education. But education, of course, is comes down to parties, because the party of each province, you know, delves out an educational system, and you don't want to have some sort of partisanship sway one way or the other. So it's often neglected. Mm-hmm. But I do think that there is some importance in my anecdotal in my life. Personal examples is I see a lot of different ways people are politically active through technology and social media. That is a disconnect from how our government views being politically active. I think the default mm-hmm. is to be politically active, to be in the physical public square and to go and register and vote and to be, you know, a registered candidate or sorry, a registered member of a party. And that's not necessarily how our generation is only, it's not the only avenue to be politically active anymore. And I think there's a disconnect there that needs a bridge.
Yeah, no, I that's a very, very shrewd point. Like, I never even thought about that in terms of like what the different constructions of political involvement are. And I know I've never heard you phrase that very well. I've never heard that as well articulated as you did, because I think there's something seriously going on there. There's not the same weight and emphasis and importance on connecting with the different medium that are involved. That is it's a really good point.
Yeah, I think a lot of younger people would vote if it was accessible on your phone. And it seems like there's, I do, I really believe, I think that there is want to get involved, but not want to get involved in the traditional sense. There's definitely interest in different ways that people, you know, post, repost on Instagram about the Palestine conflict, or a liking a tweet that, you know, promotes LGBTQ rights, or any which way. I think that there is an interest there. I don't think it's been activated in the way that it should be. But that's my personal take of what being politically active is. I've actually never said it on my podcast to that degree, but yeah, that's what I'm looking forward to, you know, researching and studying in the future. We'll just wrap up here. And where can students contact you or read your latest publications, or how could they maybe enroll in your course?
I don't know if they can enroll in my course at the moment because it seems I'm doing it. But yeah, I've published in the Canadian Geographer recently, two years ago, and then also in the Canadian Journal of Political Science. There's a number of government and community reports I've done as well, which if you just Google my name, are pretty easy to find.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Professor, for coming on the podcast. I think this has been a really interesting conversation. I hope students like it as much as I did.
Thank you very much for having me. It was greatly appreciated. Thank you.